Welcome to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker State Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox, and I'm excited today. I've got Brian Morris on the phone. I've known Brian for, somewhere between 15 and maybe, I'm trying to think now, it could be pushing 20 years.
It's probably over 20. My daughter's almost 20, and I know I met you before she was born because we met with Charlie Bishrod, I think Santa Cruz Island. I think I hunted with you. It was probably one of the first times I met you, actually.
Yeah, that had to been, it's funny. I just had Charlie, on the podcast there the other day, and we were talking about that Santa Cruz hunt, and that had to been somewhere around, I don't know, 96 or 97, somewhere right in that range.
Yeah, we did about 5 years of, trips over there. Yeah. That was a lot of fun in the off season when there was nothing else going on.
Oh man, I tell you, I wish that place still was going. I unfortunately only caught the very last one that Charlie did. And so I just got a taste. I mean, I hunted it with my compound before that, but it was, what a blast it was to go around with a stick on there and chase those sheep around and pigs and all that.
It was a blast. I look forward to doing that every year. And then I start going twice a year and was trying to squeeze out three times a year just to, get to go in the off season or just, have a place to go chase something, when deer season and turkey season wasn't going. And
yeah,
it was a fun place for many years for me.
Yeah. It sure made that long stretch between, California, most of your stuff, typically, unless you're doing a bear hunt or something that goes later in the year, most of it's kind of wrapped up in September. And then you're waiting all the way until July when that A zone blacktail season opens up if you don't have any good hog hunting spots.
I was going to say, as soon as those island trips stopped, that's when I got hot and heavy trying to find properties and places to go hunt pigs and turned in all my off season when I wasn't chasing deer and elk and turkeys and, chasing pigs all over the place. So,
I definitely want to dive into some of that stuff there. Before we get too far down the road, why don't you give me a little bit of a background of, before I met you, how you got started into hunting and maybe even more specifically into stick bows, if that wasn't indeed what you started out with right out the gate.
Yeah, I started, I don't remember the year. I was probably, 7 or 8 years old. My family was always into hunting, both of my grandparents and both grandfathers. I had one grandfather that had a shoe shop in Portland, Oregon. And for on the side, when he wasn't, repairing people's shoes, he was building lemonwood recurves and longbows and making bows to, try and make ends meet. And then my grandfather on my dad's side, he hunted everything, every season, any weapon. If there was a hunting season, he was going, and if it was bow season, he had a bow, and if gun season, he had a gun. And it just kind of was brought up into the, bow hunting, growing up. My dad mostly gun hunted. And back when I was, 11 years old, when it was my turn to get get my tag and start hunting myself, we went bow hunting. And I think I sat in a tree stand for a week with a Sagittarius, quiver on a Darton, compound. And uh-huh. I kept emptying the quiver, shooting at so many deer in the Lake Almanor area. I remember multiple times looking around like, trying to sneak down the tree, and I'm going, why am I sneaking? I'm totally out of arrows. You need to run out there, pick up all your arrows. And that's what it used to be like in that area.
Holy cow.
But I think I got my first bow when I was 7 or 8 with it was an old Bear recurve, and as I started hunting, I went into shooting a compound, and, you know, I shot a compound for about 3 years. And I was just never, you know, back then they were so heavy, you know, it was like they were made out of cast iron risers, and I could just never hold the pin steady enough. And it was easier for me just to pull back and let an arrow fly and pick a spot. And, you know, I always played baseball and football, and I thought it just came more naturally, you know, to me to, you know, yank the sights off the compound. So I did that. And then I went, you know what? I ran into Charlie Fisher out at Frontier Archery, and he'd started building recurve bows. And I said, let me shoot one of those, and start shooting and shooting it. And he's like, dude, you got to have one of these. And that was in like 1988 or 87. And, I've been shooting a stick bow since.
Wow. Good deal. Good deal. Yeah. It's funny how, you know, just fluke chances of, you know, intersecting paths change the total trajectory of one's life, isn't it?
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. I can speak the same thing, you know, with me there meeting Charlie in a quite unorthodox way, which I went into. Were you on that hunt just north of Santa Rosa there, Hopland, up there on that property when I met Charlie?
You know, possibly, because I hunted a lot of pigs there. We used to book pig hunts for the guy, and we would go in there and hunt deer.
Uh-huh.
You know, once in a while. I didn't go all the time. I kind of went as a guest on that because I had a place to hunt in Napa. But I may have been on that hunt with you. I think I remember you being there.
Yeah. So I actually had gotten up there through my archery shop that I had. So I was hunting with a compound then, and just a quick recap, because I've already told the story on the podcast I did with Charlie, but I ended up, I was driving around there, you know, on a Saturday morning trying to kind of get a lay of the land. It was probably maybe a couple of weeks into the season. And ended up, I was driving circles around where Charlie was in this draw where he was trying to stalk this buck, and ended up, you know, blowing his deer out. And then he would, you know, so he was pretty irked about that. And then I was, you know, driving out another finger ridge as he was turning to, you know, walk that direction. So he'd turn and go different direction. And then I'd turn around on that finger and drive out, you know, another little dirt road, and just was a total, you know, cartoon rodeo. By the time I got back to that little cabin up there, man, he was red faced and PO'd.
I'm surprised he didn't have you by the neck. He
just did.
Charlie's a great man. I owe him a lot. Just everybody that he's introduced me to through the archery world. But if you did something he didn't like, he told you.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You knew about it.
Yep. And I found out really quick. Fortunately, yeah. I'm a pretty good negotiator, and so I was able to talk myself out of a body bag.
Yeah, he was a big dude back then, and was still running over every place I went hunting with him. I'm like, you go by yourself, because, you know, he'd show up in, you know, AstroTurf shoes, and he'd run up and down the hills, you know, after his years of playing at Oregon Ducks and all the football he plays. Like, I can't keep up with you. You just go. I'll get there when I get there.
Right. So, right.
But
yeah. So
great guy.
Yeah. So your daughter's off to college now, huh?
Yeah. She's off to Chico State. She's just getting ready to wrap up her first year. And, so we're excited.
She's still playing soccer?
You know, she's done well. No, she had offers even at Chico State to play, and St. Mary's and Berkeley and some other places to play goalie. And she's like, I'm done. And she goes, I'm going to play my last high school game, and I'm going to turn the page, and I'm going to study ag. And she's kind of working on the, you know, on the meat side. She's doing an internship in the meats lab right now, and, you know, really enjoying that.
Nice.
I'm not quite sure exactly what she wants to do, but she's been coming home a lot lately and, you know, chasing pigs with me. So
good deal.
She's enjoying it. It's been great.
Right on. Yeah, that's pretty neat. I mean, for the benefit of the listeners, so your daughter played on multiple soccer teams every year since as long as I can ever remember. And it seemed like you were always going to some soccer tournament virtually every weekend, almost year round, it seemed like.
Yeah, it was year round. She was year round for 9 years, and it never slowed down. There was times that she would play on her local team in Fairfield, and then she would guest play for some more premier teams at tournaments, or, you know, we went to Vegas and Arizona and, you know, San Diego, multiple. I mean, we were all over the place, you know, tons of holidays, and had Thanksgiving dinner at Buca de Pepo multiple times with the team in San Diego.
Holy cow.
You know, just, yeah, it was great. I miss it. I mean, it just all of a sudden, boom, it's done.
Yeah.
You know, it was, she's off to turn the page, and, you know, which is, you know, she didn't have a whole lot of time back then to do some hunting with me. She was always able to get out and, you know, chase a pig here and there, or maybe shoot a turkey with her gun, or, you know, shot a couple pigs with a recurve and then one with her compound. And, now she's, every time she comes home, Dad, let's go hunting.
Oh, cool.
Like, yeah, I love it.
But. Yeah. Yeah. How cool is that? You must've been pretty shocked when she, decided she wasn't going to do the soccer thing anymore.
I was shocked. I was really bummed. I would, you know, it's very competitive. There's so many teams and so many kids playing, and just, the hair still right now stands up on the back of my neck at all the people and the coaches and the reporters and people that wanted to talk to her and were calling her at high school, you know, hey, come out to our camp. And, you know, it was awesome. I mean, I played a little bit of sports, and I wasn't great at it. Uh-huh. I was always had my mind on other things like bow hunting, you know, or fly fishing or something.
Right.
But uh-huh. I was bummed, and, you know, I was hoping, man, she could maybe get a couple years and play and, you know, get this watcher at that level. And she just said, that's it. You know, I don't want to do it no more.
Yeah.
So,
well, juggling, you know, an education and college and playing sports can be a challenging thing. And oftentimes what ends up happening is the compromise ends up happening on the education part. So she may have made herself a really, you know, well thought out decision in that respect.
Yeah, she, you know what, she, you know, the scholarship money in a couple of the schools was, you know, would have been good, but good meaning half the tuition for, you know, a $50,000-$60,000 a year school.
Ooh,
which,
man,
it was still a lot of money out of my pocket.
Right.
And then the state schools, you know, would offer you like $1,000, and she's like, she instantly went, you know, part of it was, I'm not going to kill myself for, you know, $1,000.
Right. Right.
And I said, well, it's not all about that. I said, if you want to do it. Yeah. And she was looking, and she, you know, she talked to a lot of the kids and the, you know, the players, and they were all on, you know, really not full units. You know, most of them were on a 5 and 6 year plan.
Right.
If they were playing sports, because when you're playing sports at the college level, which I didn't do, I didn't know anything about this. I mean, you're basically, that's what you're doing. You're training twice a day. You're training in the off season. You know, it's busy, busy, busy. And she, that's all she did. But she's just like, you know what? I'm done. I'm just, I want to do something else. And I don't want to go through my college years doing that. I want to get an education, and I want to start doing things that, yeah, other things that she loves, and which was the ag, horses or cattle. Ooh. Or that's what she's into, which I don't own a farm. So she better find herself a cowboy or a farmer. So.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I guess with the loss of the soccer, at least you're gaining more time in the field with her hunting. And that's pretty neat.
Oh, it's a blast. I mean, we both drive an hour each direction, and we meet at my friend Brad's, or uh-huh. go to another ranch that I can hunt there. And, up around Clear Lake, and it's, you know, it's great. I, you know, about every 3 weeks we seem to, you know, catch up, and we're in the hills somewhere chasing or hunting, or she's looking forward to coming home the next couple of weeks here to chase some turkeys. So
good deal.
I'm looking forward to her coming home. So
yeah, those turkeys are my nemesis. That's something that you've probably seen, you know, just in your time bow hunting, that the whole turkey population and the turkey hunting opportunities kind of, you know, grow and blossom right in front of you, huh?
Absolutely. I leave my house in the morning at 5:30 for work, and I always take the dogs out back and I'm walking them, and I can, this morning, this whole week, I can hear birds gobbling in the neighborhood.
Wow.
I mean, I'm in a subdivision and I don't even know where they're at. I know the direction, but they're everywhere. I mean, every ranch that I've hunted over the years that had no turkeys now has, you know, populations of 30 birds in a flock to 100.
Yeah.
You know, during the fall season, when they're all bunched up, they're everywhere. You know, it looks like a hillside of ants crawling around. There's so many of them. It's like, where did all these things come from?
Wow.
You know, and there's predators snacking them. I find piles of turkey feathers and bones all over the place on the ranches I'm hunting, but they're everywhere. Last year I was hunting, my deer ranch, you know, I was all over that place, walking, hiking, no turkey tracks, no nothing. Walked in there a week ago. The rancher was like, "Hey, I thought I saw some birds up there." Walked down the road. I'm like, "Holy smokes! Look like a migration of turkeys came through there." Then I run into a bunch of like 40 birds,
huh.
And half of them were toms. I'm like, "Where did all these come?" You know, they're just all of a sudden, I've got a huge flock of birds.
So had those been on the property before, or is this just a recent migration of turkeys into your place?
It's a recent migration. I would bet 10 years ago, there was a pile of birds in there.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's always the chance that you miss them, but I went in my free time, you know, with I'm hiking and stump shooting on that ranch and walking, and you're looking at tracks in the road. And, I mean, I'm always looking at something, you know, my head's always down. You're looking for sheds, you're looking at deer tracks, you're looking at, you know, bobcat, turkey tracks, or, you know, whatever. And I'm like, all of a sudden the roads, you know, they're muddy and they're just solid turkey tracks on top of deer tracks. And I'm like, where did all these things come from?
Huh.
It's a good problem to have.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. Well, the wineries are probably hating life because those things, you talk about some serious predators on the grapes. Those things will wipe out an orchard.
Absolutely. The fall season, I've shot them, and they're just full. Looks like they're full of raisins. You know,
uh-huh.
They're just eating the grapes off the vines, and probably they're a little late. They're probably, you know, when I'm shooting them, then it's, you know, they've probably already harvested and stuff, but they're just getting what's dry. But I'm sure they're hammering them, you know, when they're ripe and they're sweet. I see them, you know, a couple of ranches I have to hunt. They're, you know, you see them walking through the vineyards all day if they're not eating bugs, and when the grapes are there, I'm sure they're pecking at them. So,
yeah, yes, indeed. Well, that's encouraging. I mean, as those turkeys expand, of course, you know, a lot of this is private land you're talking about, but they'll be expanding onto public as well as they push themselves, you know, off or out of kind of overpopulating on the private. So, you know, areas that do have public land there in California should be seeing the benefit of that too.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that some of the public land hunting has gotten better and better with birds because they're just everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yeah. You get a hen that coasts off a hill and it coasts a half a mile away, and she has a hatch of, you know, 10 to 12, you know, little birds, and nothing gets to them, and all of a sudden they just keep doing that, and they're populating like crazy.
Yeah.
So
yeah. How are the hog populations doing out there that you've seen? Is it holding pretty steady, or are they kind of going in the way of the black-tailed deer, it seems like, with heavy predation and low fawn recruitment and all that? I know I talked to Bob Larson the other day and he was pretty baffled. He said, you know, in Bob's place, that if the listeners have seen that DVD Glory Hog 2, that was filmed on Bob Larson's ranch there, and that place is, you know, all but like a captive zoo. And he said that recently, you know, this last winter, he said it's been really difficult to turn pigs up there, and he's kind of figuring that there had to have been some kind of a die-off of some sort.
Yeah, I actually went over there a month ago or so, and we kind of drove around the ranch, and, you know, we didn't see much. We saw some sign. He said he's seeing more now, but, you know, that whole region over there, I've heard, is the numbers are way down. I don't know if they, you know, got into something, or it's just the cycle of life over there wiped out a bunch of them or something. Uh-huh. But he's, I know that recently he's found a bunch of sows with a bunch of little piglets, and, you know, they're out snacking grass this time of year. So
yeah, pretty, you know, visible.
He's seeing them. Yeah, they're pretty visible. They're out all day long, or they might bed up for a little while, then get back out because that grass runs right through them. But, you know, when I'm, you know, hunting over off of 5 and, you know, up around the Williams area and up in the hills and stuff there, they're loaded in there. I mean, I've gone out and I've shot at 5 pigs and killed 5 pigs since Wow. the first of the year.
Wow.
And we're, you know, the guys I go with, which, you know, Brad and Shane, Yep. and some of those guys, they, you know, we're going out, you know, with stick bows or compounds, and we're killing, you know, 1 to 5 to 6 pigs a night in like a 2-hour hunt.
Jeez Louise. So,
and we're just touching a section of the ranch. You know, we're not going all over the place. You know, if we had more time, we would probably do a lot more damage. I mean, we're getting to go in there because there's an issue with them. Yeah. Right. You know, we're on a depredation tag, and which it's a great problem to have. I mean, I would love to be on everybody's depredation tag to go pig hunting. I love it.
No question. So. Yeah. Brad's got himself a little gold mine right there.
Yeah, he's got a few ranches around there, and his family owns some land, and you know, they definitely have a problem. It's crazy. You know, we've seen, you know, hog trails and tracks, you know, 2 miles away from the hills, just right out in the flatland, where they're coming out of the hills looking for food, looking for green grass, and, you know, even water up until these last few rains we got in this last month. They were coming out of the hills early this time of year, and, you know, trying to find something to snack on. You know, nothing was growing. The acorns were gone. And so, you know, they're coming all the way out to almond orchards and eating grass, you know, in between the windrows of the trees and stuff. So
it can be pretty tough for a pig to eke out a living, you know, this time of year, especially as it gets further in towards summertime, and man, they got to spend more time out there rummaging around trying to find something to eat.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw a pig a couple weeks ago, which I know they do it. I see evidence and sign of them flipping over cow pies, but I watched one coming all the way down this flat, and he was flipping over cow pies and eating worms or mushrooms or, you know, whatever was growing underneath them. He'd just flip them over his nose, and he'd snack there for a minute, and then he'd move on to another cow pie. Huh. It was like he was going from pie to pie and getting treats. I was curious. So I'm flipping them over, and I found little sprouts and mushrooms, and, you know, you flip them over and there was bugs. So he was slurping up something.
Huh. Yeah. That's not the most appetizing of meals there in my book.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
I'd die if I thought I had to eat from under a cow pie.
Yeah. Now, those things are survivors though, man. They figure out how to make it.
Yeah. They are tough. They're one of the toughest animals I think you could hunt. I really do. I mean, they just, I think they're made for bow hunting, but I've shot a lot of them that, you know, you take them to the butcher and they pull little broadheads out of them or 30-06 rounds or, you know, or in their shoulder or armor. And it's like, man, these things are just unbelievable.
Yeah. You really have to put your shot in the right spot to make sure you're going to anchor them.
Yeah. I had a friend last night sent me a picture of a hog that he shot, which I'll actually text it to you later. He shot this hog, and he's like, check out his necklace. And it looked like he got caught in a coyote snare or something, or a wire wrapped around his neck. And it was like growing. There was like an inch and a half of skin over the top of this wire.
Whoa.
That had went into this pig. And it was just super tight around its neck, like a necklace. And it just looked weird. And, he ended up, it was out eating grass and rooting around and stuff. And he snuck up and shot it. And I went, holy smokes, look at this thing. I mean, they're just, I would have been choked out, you know?
Yeah.
But
makes you wonder how it was breathing and getting anything down its wind, down its throat there.
Yeah. Probably not a lot.
Huh.
But
no kidding. Well, how have the deer populations been holding out on your places that you've been hunting? And you're hunting primarily private there in California, right?
Yeah, I hunt. I do some hunting in Northern California. More of a kind of a tradition at this point. It used to be, you know, tons of deer in the, you know, Plumas County and area. And yeah, we just hunt up around Lake Elmanor a lot, and there was, you know, hundreds of deer. And like I said earlier, we'd, you know, quiver after quiver, you know, before I knew how to shoot or and I'd, you know, high, low, and to the right, to the left, and, you know, just spraying arrows all over the place. But that's kind of dead up there. I mean, I hardly see any deer, see more bears than deer. But, you know, the ranch that I'm hunting in Napa, you know, the rancher manages it very well. He only allows, you know, a couple guys to hunt it. And although we can legally shoot two deer on the ranch, he limits us to one deer apiece. And, you know, I'm seeing anywhere from, you know, $3 to $10 a night, and usually trying to figure out which one I want to go shoot. It's you know, I've got a really ideal spot, and I've been very fortunate to get to hunt out there. And it's all wide open country, and there's a few little oak pockets, and those deer just, they love it in there, and there's a pile of them in there. I haven't seen the numbers down at all. I haven't seen any tracks of cats or anything like that either, so hopefully they stay out of there. But they seem to be, it seems to be getting better and better every year on that ranch. And
that's encouraging.
But, you know, no, it is, but you know, some of the ranches around me, some of the gun ranches, you know, they're, you know, a lot of those guys, you know, you hear about them killing $15 to $20 a year.
Right.
And I think that has a lot to do with the numbers down on some of the properties around Napa and stuff, you know, where I live. They just get overshot, I think, you know. Everybody, you know. But that's, you know, there's not a lot of places to go that aren't private, and when you get a spot, everybody wants to fill their two deer tags, and you know, so every little fork and horn and three pointer, you know, everything from big or small gets shot. So
yeah, something to be said for managing a resource there and you know, improving, not just, you know, looking at it long term rather than, you know, the immediate, you know, week or season there.
Yeah.
So you shot a nice bear last year, didn't you?
I did. I got him up at Lake Elmanor area. Just kind of sitting up there in my stand on a Sunday afternoon. I just put the blind up. I wasn't even going to put up a stand this year, and got talked into putting the blind up, and put the blind up, walked down to the truck, grabbed my bow, turned around. I walked back up to the tree and sat up there with some sunflower seeds and water. And instantly I had a doe and two fawns come in, and they milled around the blind for an hour and a half, you know, maybe more. And the doe, at one point, I saw her kind of, you know, hitting these fawns with her hoof, like made them kind of lay down and stay. And I'd never seen a deer do that before. And as soon as she got them to stay in a spot, she turned, walked straight down the hill. I could hear her walking across this gravel road. I could hear her down by this creek, walking in the water. And then she comes back up. She just made him stay right there. She went down, got water, and came back. But as soon as she left, one of those fawns kept bleating, just meh, like every 5 seconds. And I thought, well, this is getting annoying. And then I thought, you know, you're going to get snacked here, little guy, if you don't, you know, keep it quiet. So, you know, the doe comes back up there, and the sun just went down. And about the time that I heard a snap and a pop, I was watching this doe, and her head went up, my head went up. And about the time we both looked up the hill, here comes this great big bear just boiling down the hill. And within seconds, it was standing right where she was just at with her fawns. And I mean, like 10 steps away from the tree, right underneath me. And you could just tell right away, he was a big boar. And he had that, you know, look and the posture, and just kind of cruising and he was the king of the jungle. And he just happened to walk right under the blind and was walking quartered away from me, almost broadside. and I had a 13-yard shot, and I never moved. I was sitting there, and I never had time to, you know, really stand up or anything, and came to full draw and shot, and boy, the arrow looked perfect, and he ran up there, and I thought I heard him crash, and I sat there till dark, and I just started to get down. I heard snapping and popping from where he had crashed. I went, uh-oh, it's dark. It's dark. And so I got down the tree as quiet as I could and sprinted to the truck and went back the next morning. And it must have been another deer or another bear or something that was coming over to, check him out.
Uh-huh.
Because he had fallen dead in his tracks. He was in a running type motion, and but he was a dandy. I couldn't move him. I mean, it took a couple of us. There was three of us to try and get him on a, you know, get him to a point we can get him on a quad, and
uh-huh.
and we start weighing quarters later without the guts. We had like 360 pounds of bear cow. Quarters and carcass, and yeah, he had a my buddy Tony Mudd came down and looked at it. He goes, I got to measure that. You know, I got to check that thing out. And it was a little over 22 inch skull, which is,
dang.
I have it next to an 18 inch skull, and it doesn't even look the same.
Uh-huh.
It's so much bigger and taller and got this big knot on its head and on the skull. And yeah, he's a dandy. And I was, he was a beautiful bear too, real chocolate arms and face with a real blonde coat. And so,
man, that thing had it all.
He did. He was beautiful. I mean, he really was. I don't know if I could, I haven't seen a whole lot of bears, you know, that big. You see a lot of them skirting through the woods or California, 150 pounds, maybe pushing 200 pound range, but I never see them, you know, that big. And, so
that's something that, when most guys see a bear, it's 300 pounds, you know, but a real 300 pound bear, let alone that one, sounds like with the guts in it, was probably, you know, pushing that 400 mark. That is a legitimate giant, man. They just don't come along that big all that often.
Yeah, I'm still shocked. I mean, it was the coolest. I could see it all in my head like it was yesterday, and it would have been a really cool video. I mean, he just, you know, he was cruising around like a pit bull, like, you know, no one's messing with me. And he just had that posture, like, I'm the king of the world, you know, and, it was a really cool bear. And as soon as the arrow hit him and I saw it and I heard him go down, I was like, then I about fell out of the tree.
Thing
I was strapped in because I probably would have. I was sitting there and my legs started shaking. I'm like, holy smokes, that's a huge bear. And, but you know, and I mean, you could tell he was big, but I didn't really know how big until I got up to him and went, wow, this guy's a giant.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. What are you, you're still shooting split finger, right?
Yeah. I shoot a split finger.
And then, tell me about your setup. You're shooting a blacktail, and what kind of arrows are you shooting?
Yeah, I'm shooting a blacktail longbow right now. It's a three piece.
Uh-huh.
And I've gone back and forth between woods and carbons, but just recently I kind of strictly went back to carbons. The Victory's VAP. I was talking to a guy over there, and they put me on their team, which was kind of cool. And, but I've shot those off and on for about 3 years, and you know, I really like them. They're mm-hmm. kind of that super skinny shaft.
Right.
I haven't tried any of their carbon trads yet, but, hopefully here soon I'll get some of those in my hands and give them a try. But, you know, I shoot about a 53 pound longbow right now with, shooting split fingers. And I shoot a stainless steel adapter on the end of the carbon with a, you know, with a 200 grain, Eclipse or a werewolf head.
Uh-huh.
That's what my current, you know, setup is now. And, you know, I like it. I get really good penetration and pass through shots, and, it's worked out really well.
What are you shooting a three, what, 3.5 inch or
I'm or, shooting, or I shooting I, you four. know, I go, I seem to be always changing. Right now I'm shooting four fletch, just four 3-inch.
Okay.
But I'll go between that and the four fletch in a 4-inch.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, with those super skinny arrows, it's, you know, I was trying to put bigger feathers, and I used to shoot a bigger four fletch, and boy, it just didn't seem like there was enough room on the arrow.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, and I'm amazed that, I look like I got a little target arrow or something, but it, I tell you what, with the heavy front end and system on there, but the arrows really fly good. And I've shot a recurve and longbow off and on for many years, and I seem to, I don't pull and hold, and I don't shoot a click or nothing. And, most people look at me and go, how can you even shoot the way you shoot? But I'm consistent, and I come to I'm kind of more of a snap shooter. You know, the arrow hits, I draw back and the arrow hits the, corner of my mouth where the string does, and it's gone. And, and I've just always shot well with that. I tried the three fingers under before, and I couldn't get used to it.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know why, so I just went back to a split finger, and that's what's worked, the best, for me.
Yeah. Last year I shot four 2-inch blazer, the razor feathers. So basically like a blazer vane, but they're feathers instead. And similar to what you were doing there, 200 grains up front. And I was shooting those Valkyries and with that stainless outsert. And I don't remember what the weight on that outsert was there, but that thing, like you said, you don't need a whole lot of fletching when you got a good amount of weight up front. And this year I'm going to play around with, those similar to what you're just talking about with the four, 3-inch feathers. And I was going to go to parabolic and hoping that I'd get a little bit quieter flight with a parabolic, versus that shield cut.
Yeah. Going back to your insert system, I shoot the Valkyrie insert, their center pin system, mm-hmm. with the glue on adapter, and that's what I'll put the Eclipse broadhead. I'll glue that right on the end of that.
Okay.
So that's the same system I'm shooting. I just use the tapered, glue on adapter for more of a traditional style two blade that grooves up, just glues onto that. And I did shoot some of those razors last year. I made up a dozen. I ordered some feathers, and they sent me those, and I'm like, well, I'm not going to wait. I'm going hunting and I'm running low on bullets. So I fletched them up with them, and those flew great. I mean, they really did. The shield cut was a little noisier.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you go to a parabolic, I think you'll see that will be a little quieter.
Yeah. Have you ever played around with the difference between a banana cut and a parabolic as far as from a noise standpoint?
You know, I think the parabolic is probably the quietest. I shot the banana cut years ago, a large 5.5-inch three fletch,
mm-hmm.
2018 shaft, big deltas, Wiki broadheads. And, it was noisy.
Yeah.
But I think part of it was just, it was a lot of feather.
Right.
And then I went to a four fletch that was a big high back 4.5-inch shield. And, that was noisy too, but, I never, it was noisy, but I never paid a whole lot of attention to that. It didn't make or break if I was going to hunt with it. Cause I'm like you, I like to get in close. I mean, I don't like to take a 30-yard shot. I shoot a lot and I can make that shot, but mm-hmm. man, I like getting right in the bedroom with them. I like getting, that, 7 to 15 yard range, that's where I love to be. And a lot of times I'm way too close, but I feel like at that distance, if it jumps a string, it's going to do it by an inch or so. If I'm
right,
as long as I'm on the money, I don't think that feather's going to make a lot of difference. But, I think a 5-inch three fletch parabolic is probably one of the quietest arrows I've ever shot. But for some reason, I've been sticking with four fletch for many years now.
Yeah.
I shot four fletch with a compound and kind of went back and forth. And it's easy to, do a rapid fire if you shoot. I've had several times where I've shot at a pig or even a deer or something, and you shoot, and and they're, you know, these, you know, stick bows so quiet sometimes, and it's just, you know, the wind's blowing or something, they don't hear the arrow,
right,
and they're still snacking on grass or feeding. It's like, oh, real quick, and where I'm not looking, you know, looking for that cock feather to, you know, index it right on the string, I'm just, I knock it and trying to bear down and make another shot, and hopefully a better one than the first one I missed.
Yeah.
So
what are you shooting for arrow spine with those victories?
I shoot a 400.
Okay.
And
your overall arrow length?
I shoot 30 and a half inch, which is about probably an inch and a half longer than it needs to be.
Uh-huh.
I've always shot a little bit longer arrow, trying to gain a little weight. And I think with the victories, I needed, you know, when I shot some that were a little shorter and it was a little too stiff. So the mm-hmm. little bit longer arrow for me was, you know, worked by keeping it, you know, a little bit longer.
Sure.
You know, it kind of loosened up that spine a little bit.
Yeah.
Wasn't as stiff a shaft.
Yeah. Is that blacktail, is that cut past center or cut to center, or do you know?
I believe it's cut to center.
Okay.
So it shoots an arrow really well. And I mean, it shoots a carbon, really well, where I've had issues with some bows, some of the, you know, whether it be the blacktail recurves or one of yours or Charlie's, where I didn't get as good as arrow flight. And I think the more, you know, the more center cut, you know, the stick bow is with those, that I seem to get better flight. You know, I've shot them and videoed, did the slow motion, and I guess they all kind of look like a mess coming out of the bow, but yeah. you know, the more center shot seems like they were really stabilized faster, and, you know, and even the more feather, it seemed to stabilize faster.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, I think with some of these newer bows and the stuff that you got, everybody's doing now is, you know, it seems like there's more and more center shot. And I think that's why I've been able to go to that smaller feather, you know, because my arrows seem to come out very quickly out of the bow, and they straighten up very fast. I've never bare shaft tuned anything or messed with any of that, but you know,
no, it sounds like you found a recipe that's working for you.
Absolutely. I don't know why, but I've seen over the years, I've just got the same release and over and everything just works. And which, like I said before, most people look at me and go, how do you even shoot like that? It's not mm-hmm. possible. And it just, I always felt like, well, if you could throw a baseball or shoot a shotgun, you could shoot a stick bow and you could shoot it decent. It's just a quick motion. If I draw and hold and I start shaking and I'm a mess, I'm all over the place. I'm so much better at just a quick snapshot. And it's just worked, you know?
Yeah.
Works for me anyway.
Right.
I recently gifted a bow to Buster Posey, probably some baseball fans out there. I met him about 3 months ago, and I gave him a recurve bow, and the guy was a natural. He's like, I don't know if I can do this, and he picked it up, and you know, the first five or six arrows I watched him shoot were like a softball size in this pig target. And he's like, is that what I'm supposed to be doing? I'm like,
yeah.
I said, well, I wouldn't have expected anything different from an athlete. If you could throw a, you know, if you could, you know, hit someone in the head with a baseball from home plate at
right.
outfield,
right.
I'm sure you could do it. But he just picked it up. It was a natural. And I'm like, it's, you know, not everybody's like that. You know,
yeah.
a lot of guys, you know, there's so many different methods to shooting a longbow or recurve or, you know, do you want to shoot a clicker? Do you not want to shoot a clicker? Your three fingers under, split fingers, you know, mm-hmm. there's all kinds of processes, and, you know, everybody's got their own way, you know, to, you know, shoot. And I've tried a lot of different ways, and I'm back to the kind of quarter draw, bearing down, picking a spot, pull back. And when it touches my face, it's gone. If I try and do anything other than that, I'm an absolute mess.
Yeah, I think I'd be spraying the side of the pie truck, not the pie plate, if I was shooting your style.
Yeah, I've seen guys try it and they're high and low, and I just said, don't, you know, you gotta shoot whatever works for you. You know, mm-hmm. don't, you could read a lot of books, you could watch a lot of videos, but you just gotta go out and shoot. And I used to like to shoot in the dark a lot, just to throw out a glow stick or something and just try and work on form. And then, and shoot and shoot and shoot or stand like at 5 yards in the garage, right? And okay, I'm going to pull and hold I've always fallen back to that snapshot. And, I would recommend it if you can do it, but you know, a lot of guys try it and they get in the bad habit of target panic and other things where that's not good either. Cause then you're drawn back 15 inches when you should be drawn back 29. And, you know, a lot of guys get in the habit of releasing way too early. And so it's not for everybody, but.
Yeah. Now I think, you know, it's kind of interesting that you talked about, shooting at the glow sticks in the dark and there's some guys that, you know, when they're talking about, when they're describing their aiming method, they're not sure if they're really gap shooting or instinctive shooting or, you know, split vision. If you want to find out for sure what you're doing, then I, you know, shoot it, a candle or like you said, a glow stick or something like that. And you'll find out real quick, you know, if you can shoot well, because, you know, if you're shooting truly instinctive, then you're not really aware of where that point is. And you'll be, you know, hitting near or hitting what you're aiming at, you know, in the dark, shooting at a light source that's downrange where you have no visual reference of where, you know, the point of your arrow is.
Yeah, absolutely. It's guys that I've turned on, you know, onto that have been like, oh my God, I, you know, shooting in the dark. And every time I go down to get my arrows, they were like all together. And I'm like, well, you're picking a spot and you're picking the only mm-hmm. spot.
Yeah.
So you have to concentrate, you know, you've got, and I get it. I mean, if I wasn't excited anymore to go hunting or get a little rattled when I was sneak up on a blacktail buck or a pig or something, I'd probably be time to change sports or something. But I, you know, you gotta bear down and get that spot. Once you get that, as long as you're, you know, drawn and coming to hold and you're, you know, you can concentrate long enough to, you know, you know, take that shot and then fall apart later. Well, like I do.
yeah.
But it's,
have you ever done one of those club, night shoots where it's a flashlight shoot where they get a group of guys and one guy that leads it with a flashlight and you walk up to a target and they'll give you, you know, they'll shine the flashlight on the target and they'll give you whatever, 2 or 3 seconds to shoot. Have you ever done one of those?
Yeah, I did one a few years ago over in, I think California, like traditional archers had a shoot over in, like Petaluma and they had one of those and I did, I've only done it once and it was fun. And I managed to, you know, hit some targets and miss some targets, but you know, they hold the flash on it for a second. So about the time you're drawn, they shut it off and it's like, whoa,
yeah,
you're just flinching them out there. You know, if it would have stayed on the target probably a little bit longer, I probably would have done better, but it was fun. It was an exciting time.
Yeah. It kind of throws a little bit of a curveball into your shooting and stuff, but it's a fun thing. I mean, if the target's already laid out and you're shooting a 2-day shoot or something, it's a good thing to do in the evening there to kind of, you know, keep in that same line, you know, as far as keeping the shooting going and what have you. Hey, you drew an elk tag in Nevada a handful of years ago, shot a monster bull. I have accumulated a sizable heap of elk points. And I'm going to be putting in point only again this year because I've got too many plans that would conflict if I drew. And realistically, you know, by the way things are shaping up, it might be the same story next year. But one of these times I'm going to be cashing in on those points there. Why don't you tell us how that elk hunt went? Because you shot a heck of a bull. It was, what, like 350 or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was in the 352, 354 range, somewhere in there. Before I start, if you draw that, I'll go with you. Cause that was, if I had the money to buy a landowner tag there every year, I would go do that elk hunt in Nevada every year. That was probably one of my favorite hunts.
Wow. All right.
I drew that tag 7 years ago with 6 points.
Oh,
and that's how Nevada works. You get one, you know, I drew 3 tags that year and that was the last year I drew a deer tag there as well. But I drew a deer tag, an antelope tag, and a, you know, bull tag. And it was like, I don't have enough time to do all this. I don't know if I'm having enough vacation time. I had other hunts planned but you know, I spent all my time on that hunt. I went with a good friend of mine, Gary Wright, for 10 days over there. And by day two or three, we'd found this big white bull, and he was a big, 7x7. And, later on, one of the guides over there, his name's Trevor Marks, he found his sheds and he scored it and it was like in the 370. And I've got great video, and I was all over the mountain chasing that thing every day. Every day I was able to, you know, get in on it, stalk it, but it had the biggest herd of cows and these little satellite bulls running around. And I almost got frustrated and shot one of those multiple days. But I ended up stalking them like the last day on like day 10 of my hunt and getting in to where I was I had cows all around me and I couldn't find this bull. I'm like, where did he go? And all of a sudden he comes walking up the hill and comes right to me. He's on one side of a juniper. I'm on the other side and he's bugling. I'm bugling. I'm trying to get him just to come around the tree or the juniper enough to, you know, give me a window to shoot this thing at, you know, 10, 15 yards. And something wins me and they all blow out of there. And I chased them all day long. And, you know, I'm barefooted. I was without my shoes for several hours and I had to backtrack and took me, it took me an hour to find the stupid things and, ended up almost giving up. And I saw this little dust cloud come up in front of me, like 30 yards. I'm like, what the heck was that? And thought, oh, maybe a rabbit or something. All of a sudden this cow starts walking out. I went, oh my goodness. And I got ready. The bull walks out after like 25 cows walk ahead of him. He's standing like 35 yards broadside. And I think when I released I don't think my first arrow hit before my fifth arrow was gone out of the quiver. I totally fell apart. I shot every arrow in the quiver and the bull was still standing there.
No way.
And all my arrows were in the same spot, like in a pie plate. And I was like, you have got to be kidding me. And that's how I ended that hunt. And I drove all the way home. And my boss said, are you kidding me? He said, go back. He's like, you can't work. He's like, you drew a Nevada elk tag. He said, you need to hunt till the end of the season. So I'm like, okay. So wow. I basically kind of refueled and freshened up, grabbed some more food, turned around and went back up there. And as I rolled into town, I pulled into the gas station. I met Trevor Marks with Bull Ridge Guide Service. And he had guided a friend of mine earlier in the week and they shot a nice bull. And he's like, hey, I don't have any clients. I'll go hunt with you if you don't mind. And I said, sure. So we took off this was like a Monday morning and we went to one of his spots and, instantly we're into bulls and it was like the rut, like a light switch came on. I think we called in 10 or 12 bulls that day.
Good grief.
And, you know, we kept jumping from spot to spot and we'd go hunt a spot for half an hour and then leave, drive up the road or drive up on another hill, drop into a little basin or something and cow call and bulls would light up all over and he'd go, okay, let's go this way or go that way. And then we ran into this guy. I think his name was Russ. He was from Utah and he was just out there. He was out there calling to elk and looking for like a governor type bull for somebody, you know, somebody that he knew that had a governor tag. And so he's out there with a camera and calling. He's like, hey, I'll call. And then Trevor's like, well, I'll video. And within an hour we're chasing bulls and we had a 5-point running in this way. Then he winded us and whirled. Then we had another bull coming in from another direction. And it was so much fun. I didn't have time to get excited. It was so exciting that I was already rattled and spent. Uh-huh. And I was getting frustrated. Like, okay, when is one of these elk going to stop and give me a 10-yard shot? We had this 5-point running across this flat at us. And we're like, okay, the wind's blowing in his direction. It's a matter of time before he whirls and he sure enough throws on his brakes, whirls the other direction. We had another bull bugling over here. So we kind of went around the corner and there was this kind of a makeshift little range fence like maybe an outfitter had a mule or had something in there, and he had this little some split pine that he made this fence out of. And as I'm crossing that, I look out ahead of me, and here's this bull raking his horns on a tree, like at 35, 40 yards out. And Trevor says, just, you know, kneel down. He set the camera up. Russ took two or three steps behind him. He cow called, and that thing, here he came. I mean, just bugling the whole way. And matter of fact, when I shot him, he just started to bugle, and I shot him at like 12 yards, and he whirled and stopped, and I got a second arrow at him at like 10 yards. He actually got closer, and he just whirled. And I was, you know, had my backpack on, which I don't like shooting with, and but it was crazy. I mean, he went, you know, we left him because he went down this hill, and you know, we thought he was still alive, and you know, ended up tracking him out, you know, the next morning, and but it was exciting. I mean, that was one of my most memorable hunts, you know, elk hunting for sure. And I saw big bucks. I saw a big antelope. I saw bighorn sheep. I saw tons of elk and no other hunters.
Man.
You know, I mean, Nevada does it right. As far as everybody gets, you know, frustrated at the end of the draw, you're like, oh, I didn't draw. And you see that they give all these tags, but there's so many areas and units and places to go. I never ran into another hunter. I knew that I had a friend hunting there that had drew with 4 points that year.
No way.
And we both live, you know, 10 miles apart. He lives over in Napa and I live in Fairfield, and we both drew. He had 4 points. I had six, and we both shot bulls and both ended up shooting bulls, you know, with Trevor doing the call in and video on. Yeah. You know, it was exciting. I'm glad that they changed it, because I think you only have to wait 7 years. So next year I can start applying again for Nevada. So,
man, oh man, I've been putting in point only all except for 1 year. And the 1 year that I decided I was going to cash in my points, I want to say I had 15. And Rodney York, you know, Rodney, he put in, yeah, he had 14. He drew and I didn't. Which is like, I mean, that's just the way it works in Nevada. You know, a guy with 1 point might draw and you with 15 or not, but
that's the way it works. You just, if you want to hunt there, you just need to apply for everything every year. And,
yep.
And if you draw an elk tag or a sheep tag, you're probably going to get everything else that you applied for as well. That's just the way it works. I think they probably draw your name out of the hat and go, okay, you know, Brian Morse. And they're going to go, okay, well, there's deer tags available still, and there's antelope tags, and there's sheep tags, you know.
Right.
It's like, holy smokes, there's a, you know, $4,000 ding on the credit card.
Yep.
But yeah. It is what it is.
Man, oh man. Yeah. I'm just, it's killing me that I've got, you know, too many, they need to put more days in the month of August and September and just spread it out a bit, because it's hard to get everything done in that, you know, short length of time.
Yeah, they really should. That would be a good state to have a, you know, most guys aren't going to hunt mule deer for a month. But if you could do a first and second season, and I don't know why they don't do that, you know, and still have, they could have some quotas, and, you know, during the bow season, they're for sure not filling 100% of the tags.
Yeah.
And it would be great to have a first season, second season, and they could double it. I don't know why they don't do that. You know, where guys can have a chance to go in there. I mean, most guys would spend 7 or 10 days, maybe, you know, hunting, or in the back country, or even if they're pulling down a gravel road, they're not going to spend a month there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I used to love to go late, you know, in Nevada, and, but I didn't like hunting them as much because they weren't in velvet. I love seeing that velvet rack or 10 velvet racks sticking up from sagebrush or, you know, out of a juniper limb or something. And, you know, I would find later, you know, they're in the, you know, the velvet's rubbed off and they're all white horned and they're, you know, they're a little tougher to find. They're buried, you know, buried up a little bit more, but, you know, it's, hopefully I draw this year. I've got 7 points. So,
oh,
we'll
wow.
See what happens.
Holy cow. You've been accumulating quite a few there.
I've been trying to draw a special unit that I hunted for 9 years in a row with my dad. And we drew it every year. Every year we applied, we got it. Both of us would get the tag, and it was phenomenal. And then I switched and started. I went over to Ruby Valley one year and hunted over there. And then I started hunting in the middle of the state around Austin, and I, you know, had good areas and found bucks every place I went. That's one good thing about Nevada. If you put some time in or find them, you'll always seem to find a pocket of, you know, decent bucks that you could go hunt for, you know, a week, as long as you don't go blow them out or, you know, totally screw it up on the first day or something, you know, and send them out of the country. Right. But, I'd like to get that. I got a phone call today from Larry Jones. He's like, "Hey, I got 7 or 8 deer points for Nevada. You want to apply with me?" And I said, "I already applied. I don't think I could change it, but I said, call South."
I said,
he's got like 1 or 2 points, and I think he really wants to go hunt mule deer, the rubies this year.
Yeah.
So I said, I don't know if he applied or not, but you with all those points might help him draw. So.
Yeah. I talked to him earlier today, and it sounds like we're going to try to put in together, and that'd be a pretty darn fun hunt. I mean, I've followed Larry since I was 18 when I saw, you know, his first video, not his first video, but the first video that I saw of his, let me rephrase that. And it would be, I've hog hunted with him before and all that, but to actually be able to spend some time up there mule deer hunting, I mean, he's the reason why I got into mule deer hunting. And then Dwight Shue's book, is the reason why I became effective at hunting them. And so, you know, between the two of those guys, if I got to spend any amount of time in the mountains with them, it'd be pretty special.
It is. I've spent a number of, hunts, you know, chasing pigs and turkeys and stuff with Larry. And, you know, if he would have called me 2 days ago, I probably would have changed my plans to do that. I'm glad you didn't apply, because I'm like, hey, call him. call him.
Yeah.
You know, I said, I just talked to South the other day, and he's like, you know, hey, you know, anybody got any tags? I really want to hunt Nevada this year.
Yeah.
And, but I've learned a lot from Larry. I mean, you know, I've done a lot of video and stuff with him, and some stuff with Bowhunter and him and Charlie years ago. And
yeah.
You know, it's always frustrating when you're the guy behind the camera and all you want to do is hunt, but it was fun. And, you know, I learned a lot. And even this past season, we hunted some turkeys together, and he may actually come down the next couple of weeks and do it again. But I mean, the calling that the guy can do, and you know, he really is unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, last year he came down and he had surgery on his shoulder, and he pushed it and he tried to get out there and shoot too quick. So, and then he tore some muscles or ligaments or something. So he showed up and he was, you know, had a leather tab on his recurve bow, and he was pulling it back with his teeth. He was a little frustrated. He probably wouldn't want me telling everybody, but he missed 4 or 5 birds and was really having a tough time. And he'd practiced and just shot and shot. We got done turkey hunting and he just shot and just was determined to get a bird with that, you know, drawing his bow with his mouth and shooting. Uh-huh. And finally on the third day, I'm like, hey, we're heading over to Bob Larson's, and like, we got to be there in an hour, and it's a 2-hour drive. And he starts calling aggressively and going nuts. And it was like, it was magical. All these birds come flying out of this vineyard. They were flying out of these oaks. And then these big toms were fighting these jakes. I'm like, and I'm thinking, why didn't you do that 3 days ago? We could add all these birds in here. He ends up, you know, we had two toms come in at like 7 or 8 yards, and he comes to full draw, and he kind of let down a little bit, and he drew again and just absolutely pinwheeled this big tom. And he was so excited, and it was an exciting time. It was like 3 days of frustration for, you know, for him and me both. And,
yeah.
You know, these birds are standing there at 10 yards and 15 yards. He's like, I don't feel comfortable that far.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, and I, you know, I'm sitting behind a camera thinking, how do I shoot one through this lens?
Right.
And,
right.
But it was a great time. I'm hoping he can come back this year and chase some more, but, yeah, that'd be a fun hunt. I hope you guys draw.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. And I appreciate the referral there. That was really nice of you to pass that along there. You know, I'm crossing my fingers and toes and all that, and hoping that we can pull one out of the hat there.
Yeah. So as soon as he said, I think I got like 7 or 8 points, I'm like, I know a guy that has like one, and you guys are friends, and you'd probably do, you know, you both like to video, and you're, it'll be a good time. And I'm like, call South.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I could have even changed mine. I think once you apply, I think it's, you're done. But I don't know. I didn't even look into it. I immediately thought of you since we talked a week ago about landowner tags and stuff like that. I went,
right.
You better call South right away before he applies himself.
Good deal. Good deal. Well, hey, speaking of shooting, I have got to get ready to head down to the local pistol range here. And every Tuesday night, they have a indoor archery shoot, and I can only shoot about 7 or 8 yards inside my shop. And so I get to stretch it out to that whopping distance of 20 yards. And so I got to roll it up here so I can go shoot some long range.
All right. Well, have a good time tonight. Shoot straight.
For sure. Yeah. Hey, I appreciate your time here, Brian, and getting on here and carving out some of your evening here.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Sure thing. All right, man. Look forward to talking to you again.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Western Bowhunter podcast, please subscribe to the show so that you will automatically be notified when new episodes are posted up. Please take the time to give us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. This will help us in the podcast rankings and will help us grow. If you have a topic you'd like to hear about or a guest that you'd like to hear from in a future episode, email south@stalkerstickbows.com with podcast in the subject line. Many years have passed me by. I've gone down.